Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading today from a new source, a quarterly journal called The Passenger Pigeon, which is a publication of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. I've been a member of the WSO since the late 70s, and I have a wonderful collection of these quarterly journals. The journal publishes a mix of scientific research done by Wisconsin field biologists and ornithologists, and also historical essays and personal essays. I'll be reading Exquisite Hours by Ken Lange from volume 64, numbers 1 and 2, spring-summer 2002. Ken Lange is the retired naturalist from Devil's Lake State Park. Maybe you heard him lecture there at the park, or maybe you've bumped into him on one of the trails at Devil's Lake. He wrote with Mike Mossman the book Breeding Birds of the Baraboo Hills. He's also has written other books, which I will mention at the end of this reading. Exquisite Hours. I must begin this essay with a confession. I had intended to write about nature and religion, or nature and spirituality, but as I began collecting my thoughts, I realized that I actually was writing about nature and the appreciation of beauty and wonder. In other words, nature and aesthetics. So let's see where this approach takes us. But first, a little personal history. Initially, I was a lister, always eager for the chase to find new birds. But after a while, new birds were scarce and I began losing interest in bird watching. It had lost its novelty. Eventually, thanks to an expanding interest in nature in general, I returned to bird watching, but with an emphasis on bird distribution and ecology. So what stirs us in our encounters with birds? What experiences do we find most enriching? I've been stirred in many ways. For example, by broadwing hawks, hundreds of them, migrating in fall over Wisconsin's Devil's Lake, by swallowtail kites soaring amid billowing clouds over the Everglades sawgrass, by a prairie falcon stooping from its eyrie on West Butte in the Pawnee National Grassland in Colorado, by a green jay bursting from cover in Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge in Texas, by a painted bunting framed in the leaves of sea grape in Key West, by a hermit thrush in northern Wisconsin singing from just a few feet away, and of course by warblers in springtime. For to come upon warblers in early May was to forget time and death, as Theodore Rethke so poignantly expressed in The Far Field. The images can be overwhelming. You want to hold them close to your heart to savor them forever, but of course they do fade. It is inevitable. Yet ever more moments occur. In retrospect, this is what constitutes our lives. Moments. That cliche about enjoying each moment is perhaps more significant than we realize. And for a naturalist, at least for me, these moments are always intertwined with light and shadow, with the wonder of spring and the sweet sadness of fall, with falling snow and spectral ice crystals. In other words, with the wheel of the seasons, as the New England writer John Hay expressed it. So savor each moment, yet realize that the wheel keeps turning. I am touched especially by these lines from Anna Wickham's poem, Song. Eternal in beauty are short-lived flowers. Eternal in beauty, these exquisite hours. I recall watching a half dozen white-winged crossbills feeding in spruces in the Three Lakes conifer swamp on a recent Northwoods trip. As the sun dropped ever lower, they continued to feed in the tops of the trees against the blue sky and the swelling moon, while a red squirrel chattered intermittently and ravens called in flight. The lure of the North Woods. It was all very special, and then I thought of another time in this same swamp when I first saw white-winged crossbills. I was younger then, much younger, but the memory returned over the years and made this present moment even more special. So what does one remember of a given day, a given event? When I reflect upon, say, my latest breeding bird survey in Hemlock Draw in the Baraboo Hills, I think of the birds, of course, but also I recall experiences that can't be quantified. I see myself standing amid old-growth hemlocks as rays of golden light stream through the needles, then flicker all around me in an ever-changing pattern. Actually, in looking back, I realize that it's all related. The sun and the hemlocks and the birds are inseparable, really. Increasingly, I'm finding myself affected by supposedly mundane observations. For example, tracking migrants in spring and fall, then missing them when they leave as you would old friends who have departed on a far journey. In fact, as time moves on, I find that I'm becoming more appreciative of my human friendships as well. I like to think that all this means that I am becoming more feeling, more alive, because of my nature-related activities. We are alive, of course, because of our senses. So the more our senses are stimulated, at least in a natural way, the more alive we will be. Humans essentially are seeing creatures, but the other senses, such as hearing, can also be evocative. One way in which birds enrich us through their songs, and in my case, the bird songs that pull most powerfully at my heartstrings, are those of childhood. I hear a house wren or eastern meadowlark, and immediately I'm transported to another time. I'm tempted to say another era, when life was simpler, and a nickel, for example, was a lot of money. I especially like these lines from Sarah Teasdale from Meadowlarks. What have I to fear in life or death, who have known meadowlarks whistling in silver light? Our sense of smell also stirs memories. The blossoms of wild plum and chokecherry, for example, evoke the glory of spring, while the flowers of wild grape mark the transition from spring to summer. But the most fundamental of the senses is touch. A person can still cope without sight or hearing, smell or taste, but without the sense of touch, one cannot survive. Keep in touch, we tell our friends. A caressing wind, the delicious coolness of spring water on a hot, humid day, a pelting rainstorm, the feel of snowflakes falling on bare skin. We are thereby united with the world. Touch can also connect us with our environment in unexpected ways. A morning cloak butterfly once alighted on my wrist and for the next 10 minutes or so investigated my skin with its proboscis, which felt cool and moist. I could not detect its feet. I expect that all of us who have spent time in the outdoors in pursuits ranging from fishing and hunting to botanizing and birdwatching have on occasion experienced a trance-like moment when we lost awareness of ourselves and felt a communion with nature. But there is a paradox here for one with biological training, since such a person is an observer, an analyzer, and therefore should not lose consciousness. My experience is that such moments occur unexpectedly and generally in quiet and unhurried surroundings, and I believe that they originate from within ourselves. So I wonder, do poets and artists experience such moments more often and with more intensity than those of us who are more scientifically oriented? Let me give you an example of such a moment that I experienced. I'm quoting from my journal for 14 May 1999. A clear morning after a cool night, I walk on the gravel road near Alt Peter's cabin adjoining Devil's Lake State Park, enjoying the bird chorus. A morning warbler flies into a shrub near me, then flies into a black cherry tree, and at a height of some 12 feet, sings a half dozen times. I watch it in direct sunlight, and each time it sings, I see a puff of air trail away from its beak. Never before have I witnessed the breath of a bird. And then I thought of other life forms, and then I imagined a vibrant and breathing earth, sentient just like this bird. But nature is indifferent, there can also be moments of discomfort and even terror. I'm reminded of these lines by the poet E.E. Cummings. I've traveled all alone through the forest of wonderful, and my feet have surely known the furious ways and the peaceful. I suppose that all of us at one time or another have dreamed of being someone else, someone supposedly more fortunate or better known. But how many of us have identified with a certain animal? In his essay, The Innocent Fox, naturalist philosopher Loren Isley tells of the time when he fell asleep on a beach by a stranded boat, then awakened at dawn to see two small projecting ears lit up by the morning sun. Beneath them, a small face looked shyly up at him. It was a fox pup from a den beneath the boat. The animal in its innocence picked up a bone and shook it, inviting Isley to play. On impulse, Isley picked up another bone and shook it in his teeth, and for one special moment they tumbled around and around, the fox and the human. But Isley had seen his miracle the way the universe begins for all things, and so he rolled the pup on its back and literally ran for the nearest ridge. The world was swinging back to normal, and the adult foxes would be returning to the den. Isley regarded this experience as the gravest, most meaningful act he would ever accomplish, but he knew that there would be no sense reporting it to the scientific societies. I have nothing quite so dramatic to report, but I do recall an encounter with a small mammal, a short-tailed shrew, as it was popping in and out of a snow tunnel. I watched it for a while and then went down on my belly and literally found myself face to face with a squeaking bundle of nervous energy, all vibrant and much more alive than I imagined when I was standing. Afterwards, I realized that during this brief encounter, I'd been part of the shrew's world, the dampness and the wet odors, and nothing else had mattered. This idea of shifting into another life form, like a shaman changing at will between a man and a bear, has a long and rich cultural history among Native people in a number of countries. If you're interested in this sort of thing, read John Hanson Mitchell's Ceremonial Time. Mitchell's discussion of changelings can at times be eerie, but it's always provocative. My training has been in science, but evermore I find myself in empathy with the philosophy expressed by writers such as the biomedical investigator Lewis Thomas. When the answers we seek are beyond the limits of science, he writes, they may yet be retrieved by fleeting glimpses in certain poems. Here's an example, I think, of what Thomas is referring to. It's from the poem 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird by Wallace Stevens. I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of inflections or the beauty of innuendos, the blackbird whistling or just after. The activist nature writer Rick Bass, discussing nature and art in the Book of Yak, offers these thoughts. Science has its own wildness, but the science we have been taught pauses at the edge of borders, does not usually spill over unless by accident. Walt Whitman talked about a free margin, the idea that you should not be too precise or scientific about nature, or the thing you are touching and measuring will be compromised. I do believe this. Nature is larger and more intricate and mysterious than we can comprehend or perhaps even imagine. Such musing, I expect, become more pronounced with the passing of time. I never would have written such an account years ago, although in retrospect I realized that these thoughts have been nurturing for decades. So what do I believe in? The miracle of the seasons, of course, but also the big friendly dogs, Irish music, poems that sing, the precious days of childhood, warm lasting friendships, and Esther, my wife, not necessarily in that order. And I expect that what I am searching for is wholeness, and attunement of self and world that involves both nature and people. Let me conclude with a quotation from a 19th century explorer and naturalist, Thomas Belt. If happiness consists in the number of pleasing emotions that occupy our mind, how true is it that the contemplation of nature which always gives rise to these emotions, is one of the great sources of happiness. Enjoy your days, enjoy your moments. Ken Lange wrote this wonderful essay. He has written quite a few other books, but the one I'll mention here is A Naturalist's Journey. It's the story of his life and also of all the many people he's known. His last name is spelled L-A-N-G-E. I also wanted to talk about the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. They began in 1939. Throughout our history, they say on the website, we have sponsored birding field trips, hosted annual conventions, published a quarterly journal and a monthly newsletter, sponsored research grants, supported the conservation of bird populations and habitats, documented and evaluated rare bird records, and provided countless opportunities for people to enjoy Wisconsin's birds. I hope you will explore their website and consider joining them, wsobirds.org. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.